Indulge your imagination with me this morning, if only just for a moment. Suppose it were possible for you to be instantly transported to the continent of Africa, to Kaduna, Nigeria in particular, and that suddenly you found yourself ushered into the Sunday morning worship service occurring at the NKST church there. I can assure you the differences from your typical Sunday morning experience would become immediately apparent to you. The accommodations of their church buildings, the rhythms of their music, the colors of their clothes, the length of the service. And your differences, of course, would prove equally obvious to them. Look at that Owebo, the white man, in his cuffed pants and button-down collared shirt. Didn't anyone tell him that style went out in the 50s? Despite all the superficial differences, however, it wouldn't take long for you to identify with the deep convictions we share in common with them. The reading of the scriptures, the God-focused prayers, the preaching of the gospel, the integrity of real Christian fellowship. Let me tell you something, friends, it would forever change you to worship side by side with brothers and sisters who have suffered so greatly for their allegiance to Jesus Christ. Many of whom, as you well know, have had their homes burned to the ground, their jobs taken away. They've been physically attacked, shot at, had family members murdered, in some cases forced to send their children hundreds of miles away so as to ensure their own safety and protection. There you sit on the Lord's Day morning, surrounded by such folk who have never known anything but a kind of Christianity that accepts the experience of persecution as a normative way of life. That's all they've ever known. And then Dr. Antiev steps into the pulpit and says to the congregation, God has blessed us with a great honor today. Visiting from Christ Community Church in California is... And he names your name. And then he looks over at you and he bows. He extends his hand and says, would you please come and speak a word to our congregation? Well, your inclination at first blush is to acknowledge his offer, but to kindly decline. No, thank you. But when Antiev looks in your eyes and smiles, your heart melts. And so you stand up to your feet, though it feels like a vice has gripped your throat. Your palms begin to sweat. Your stomach turns over. With each step up to the platform, it feels as though your legs are swimming in wet concrete. You then manage to turn around and face the congregation, and what do you see? 1,000 faces looking back at you in dead earnest, ready to heed any word you might offer. It's the attitude, beloved, of people on the Lord's Day when they go to church thinking that this may be the last Sunday they ever have together. They don't complain about the length of the service, you see. There may not be another service. Now, here's my question. What would you dare say to them? What word from God would you bring to them? What word of hope, encouragement, comfort, strength? Several years ago, I had the opportunity to speak at a Sunday morning chapel for the Oakland A's and the Milwaukee Brewers. And a friend of mine, the one who had coordinated my being there, said, Art, let me give you one little suggestion. I said, sure, Jim, go ahead. He said, don't tell them stories about when you used to play baseball. When preachers do that, athletes immediately turn them off. I mean, can you imagine doing such a thing? Let me tell you about the days when I used to play first base for the Christ Community Church softball team, you know? I mean, to make that kind of comparison, you see, would be to insult the significance of what they do. Why? Because by comparison, my own experience is so paltry, so comparatively trivial. So what word of encouragement are you going to bring to these suffering Nigerians? Oh, brothers and sisters, I can identify with your plight this morning. For you see, I was persecuted once when I was in the fourth grade and the other children wouldn't let me play Ring Around the Rosies because I said I was a Christian. What experience of persecution could any of us draw upon that would not serve to insult, demean the dignity of their sufferings? So there you stand in front of these persecuted Christians, eager to listen to you, wanting a word of comfort and hope. What word from God do you speak to them? The way I feel at this very moment, beloved, the word I would speak to them would be the truth of Revelation chapter 20. I would attempt to set before them John's glorious vision of the millennium. A portion of the God-breathed word, not for Christians who recreationally search the scriptures for bits and pieces of information concerning the future, bits and pieces of information that make very little practical contribution to Christian living, except perhaps to provide a kind of vicarious thrill. Rather, John's vision of the millennium is a word from God that is relevant to every Christian in that it speaks to this very age in which every Christian lives. Christians who in particular are living in the context of great persecution and suffering. It was a word that was spoken directly to comfort and console and strengthen the Asia Minor Christians of the first century. And unless your understanding of this text appreciates that, you will miss it. You'll be wrong. It's a word that is equally relevant to the persecuted Christians of Nigeria. Moreover, my friends, it is a word that is just as fresh for us this morning because the millennium concerns our own day and time. The time between the first and second comings of Jesus Christ. Now, you have to hold me accountable to that statement and see if the text proves the point. Throw aside all theological systems and be honest, shall we, with the text. You remember the context that brings us to chapter 20? One by one, we have systematically witnessed the exit of all of God's enemies. Babylon the Great, this world system in opposition to God, has fallen. Chapter 17, 18, first part of chapter 19. Then at the end of chapter 19, what did we see? The overthrow of the beast and the false prophet. Remember? The end of verse 20 there in chapter 19, these two were thrown alive into the lake of fire that burns with sulfur. And what about all the armies of humanity that sided with them in opposition to God and His people? Verse 21, and the rest. And we know from earlier in the passage, the rest means every other human being who is not a Christian. And the rest were killed by the sword of the rider on the horse, the sword that came from his mouth, and all the birds were gorged with their flesh. It was the fulfillment we took great pains to see 2 weeks ago of what was prophesied in Ezekiel 38 and 39. God's overwhelming victory in the great and final apocalyptic war, the last battle. It was mentioned in chapter 11, mentioned in chapter 16, mentioned in chapter 17. Here again, we saw it at the end of chapter 19. We'll get a final look at it again in the middle of chapter 20. In each case, it's a look at the very same battle, photographed from different vantage points, so as to call our attention to specific features that suit John's purpose each step along the way. All of which reminds us, beloved, that these visions recorded for us by John are not to be set end to end as though it was his intention to provide us with a strict chronological sequence of events. We've seen this over and over again in the Revelation. In the telling of his story, there are several themes that are recapitulated over and over again. For example, the last battle mentioned 5 or 6 times. The second coming mentioned several times. The final judgment mentioned several times. The eternal state. We read of it in chapter 7, read of it in chapter 11, read of it in chapter 21 and chapter 22. You will always go wrong with the Revelation until you see this recycling of major themes. And that is the very thing that we need to keep in mind when we now come to the beginning of chapter 20. Now, to our logical way of thinking, our westernized way of thinking, the 20th chapter in a book always follows the 19th. But does this automatically imply that the material in the 20th chapter represents a chronological movement forward from that which appears at the end of the 19th chapter? Not in the Revelation. The fact of the matter is, beloved, this is a pattern that we have seen John use before. Let's let John interpret John, shall we? The relationship between chapters 19 and 20 imitates a pattern that was introduced to us earlier in chapters 11 and 12. How does chapter 11 conclude? The 24 elders in heaven sing in praise to God. And what is the message of their music? The time has come for the judging of the dead and the rewarding of God's servants. Now that's clear, isn't it? It's the end. It's the last day. It's the final judgment. And so one would assume that when chapter 12 opens, we'd now be given a vision of the new heavens and new earth. After all, we know something of the storyline. We know enough to know that that's what follows final judgment, eternity. But is that what we find? Not hardly. We come to chapter 12 and we're confronted with a flashback, a prequel. John recycles us back to the very beginning of the New Testament period as he describes the birth, resurrection, and ascension of Jesus Christ. And that, you see, is the pattern he employs here once again. In fulfillment of Ezekiel 38 and 39, chapter 19 concludes with a vision of the last battle, specifically as it concerns the conquest of the beast and the false prophet. Then, beginning in chapter 20, verse 7, we find a recapitulation of that same battle. The fulfillment of Ezekiel 38 and 39, language from that text is used right there, only with the camera's lens now focused on Satan. So what about this little passage squeezed in the middle, chapter 20, verses 1 to 6? It's another flashback. Once again, John recycles us back to the very beginning of the New Testament period. I mean, friends, look at it. This isn't rocket science. Not if you don't have a theological agenda to prove. It's very obvious. What happens in the last verse of chapter 19? All the armies of the rebellious human race are destroyed, gone, obliterated. But that forces us to ask a devastating question. If we're to understand the events of chapters 19 and 20 to occur chronologically, who are the remaining nations left for Satan to deceive in chapter 20, verse 7? And how can it be said in chapter 20, verse 3, that Satan is prevented from deceiving the nations if all these people were killed at the end of chapter 19? In other words, who's left to be deceived? No one, if you read this chronologically. It's a problem, however, that altogether disappears if, in keeping with the literary style of this book, you see verses 1 to 6 as another flashback, a return to the beginning of the New Testament era, which is precisely, beloved, what this is. You say to me, you know, well, Art, I'm pretty savvy, theologically speaking. I hear what you're saying. You're one of those millennialists. Now, beloved, throughout the entire course of this study, at least as much as I can remember, I have intentionally never used that word to speak of myself. You say, well, that's just because you're trying to be sneaky about it. No. It's because the term itself is a misnomer. The term amillennialism implies a position that asserts that there is no such thing as a period of time referred to as the millennium. Millennium being the Latin word for a thousand. But beloved, how could I hold that view and at the same time be honest with this text that six times mentions a period of a thousand years? I'm not suggesting there is no millennium. To the contrary, not only do I affirm the reality of such a thing, I'm suggesting that we're living in the midst of it right now. The real question you need to answer is, what is the millennium? And all I want to ask you to do is, let's let the text answer that for you. But before we do, two essential facts that you need to keep in the forefront of your mind. Number one, other than Revelation chapter 20, nowhere else in all the Bible is the millennium, this thousand-year period, ever mentioned. And two, as I've said to you repeatedly over the last 2 years, the book of Revelation does not furnish us with any new information. Concepts that are not found in other parts of the Bible. Rather, it reasserts what the Bible says elsewhere, only in an apocalyptic style. You say, well, Art, you're not listening to yourself. Those very points are contradictory. But, my friends, they're only contradictory if the millennium is something altogether foreign to what the rest of the New Testament teaches. And here's the point. It's not. The concept of the millennium, by name, unique to Revelation 20, is just another way of illustrating two glorious truths that are taught throughout the totality of the New Testament Scriptures. According to Revelation 20, two features distinguish this great epoch in God's redemptive program. The two features, you see, that I would want to set before my suffering Nigerian brothers and sisters were I given the opportunity. For this morning, we'll consider the first of these two. And it is this. The millennium is that period of time during which the ultimate destruction of Satan is expressed in a preliminary fashion. Let me give that to you again. The millennium is that period of time during which the ultimate destruction of Satan is expressed in a preliminary, an anticipatory fashion. It is, as it were, the anticipation of the consummation that awaits him. Now remember the context. We've been seeing the exeunt of all God's enemies. Babylon is gone. The beast is gone. The false prophet is gone. But there is, as you well know, one final enemy that remains. The enemy that has stood behind all of the other of God's enemies. The one who has inspired all of the other enemies, the great red dragon. All the other prior enemies were nothing but marionettes dancing on a string held in his hand. Which is why then, in John's telling of this story, he has saved the demise of this enemy for the last. But his destruction, you see, occurs in two phases. A preliminary phase, chapter 20, verses 1 to 3. And a consummated phase, an eternal phase, verses 7 to 10. Verses 1 to 3, then, are the anticipation of that consummation. Now, here's how we'll go about this. Let's just simply watch it unfold. And then we'll return to see if we can understand what it means. Verse 1. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding in his hand the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain. Take note, friends, not only of what's said, but what's not said. You say, well, what's not said? Well, this is not the first time we've seen an angel coming down out of heaven. Even in the most recent chapters, back in chapter 18, verse 1, we were given to see this very same kind of thing. An angel descending from heaven. Except there, all of our attention was drawn to his appearance. The entire earth, the text says, was lit up by his glory as he makes this announcement that heralds a new stage in God's redemptive program. Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. The world system has now been destroyed. In chapter 19, verse 17, we saw another angel. And again, attention was given to his appearance. He stood surrounded in the light of the sun as he too made an announcement that declared a significant advancement in God's program. Come, gather for the great supper of God. In other words, the last battle is about to occur. The final defeat of all of God's enemies. Gather for it. Both of these angels come out of heaven, announcing a strategic movement forward in the outworking of God's program. Both, consequently, are distinguished by their glorious appearance. Here, however, no attention is given to the appearance of this angel. Why? In part because, unlike the others, his coming out of heaven is not with the intention to inform, but to perform. In other words, all the attention here is not focused on how he looks, but on what he does. And what does he do? Notice the implements that give us a hint. John sees in his hand a shiny key and an iron chain. What is the key to? He tells us. The abyss, the bottomless pit. What's this chain? Well, it may mean an ordinary kind of chain. It also might refer more specifically to leg irons or handcuffs, the same kind of chain with which the apostles Paul and Peter were all too familiar. But why are these implements said specifically to be sitting in his hand, or better yet, held in his hand? Because they're about to be put to use. Who is this angel? It is Satan's jailer. Verse 2. He seized the dragon, that ancient serpent who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years and threw him into the pit and locked and sealed it over him. Now, beloved, what is this bottomless pit, this abyss? Well, John doesn't develop it here because he's already done so, and he assumes that we remember what he said. Back in chapter 9, at the sounding of the fifth trumpet, John sees a star fall from heaven to earth. He identifies this star as the angel of the bottomless pit, the abyss. This angel had two names, Abaddon, Apollyon, both of which mean the destroyer. That fallen star was Satan. He was authorized by God to open the bottomless pit and release his demons out on the earth to torment unbelieving people. One of God's judgments on the unbelieving world. And that, you see, is what the bottomless pit is. It is the place where demonic beings are confined while they await their final destiny in the lake of fire. In the symbolism of the Revelation, it's portrayed as a kind of giant subterranean cavern with a narrow opening at the top that can be opened or closed, locked and sealed. Here, we're told, this prisoner is seized. The word means a fast and forcible seizure. And he is hurled, thrown into this bottomless pit. Did you notice, by the way, his unique identification? He seized the dragon, that ancient serpent, who is the devil and Satan. Why this fourfold complex of names? Why not just he seized the dragon? These are all the names that John uses in the Revelation to refer to the devil. Why all four? On the one hand, it reminds us of how dangerous he is. He's a dragon, speaking of his ferocity. He's the ancient serpent, reminding us of his powers to deceive, as he deceived Eve in the garden. He's the devil and Satan, the one seeking our damnation by his slanderous accusations against us before God. On the other hand, my friends, this terrifying description ultimately serves to display the surpassing greatness of God Himself, who so easily here renders Him impotent. You say, well, how can you say that, Art? God isn't even mentioned here. Precisely. It isn't God who imprisons Him. Nor is it even said that Christ imprisons Him. Only an unnamed angel. It almost implies the insignificance of the devil. And he is confined, we're told, to this pit for 1,000 years. Is this a literal 1,000 years? Dear friends, if a person simply opens their Bible to Revelation 20 and seeks to understand what it means without first appreciating the texture and flavor of the prior 19 chapters, then most likely he will read chapter 20 both chronologically and literally. But if a person rightly appreciates all that has come before this, he will then be sensitive to the literary design of this book. For example, as we've already discovered, that it does not set forth a strict chronological sequence. Moreover, that the use of every other number prior to this one in the book is used symbolically. A beast with 10 heads? The 7 spirits of God? An innumerable group of people? 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes of Israel? Beloved, I would remind you of chapter 1, verse 1. It provides us with the programmatic nature of this entire book. John tells us, it's my intention to communicate these things to you by way of signs and symbols. Who am I then to come at it a different way? Moreover, what are the clues in this text that indicate that this 1,000 years is not to be read in a literal way? What are the clues that appear in the immediate context? Is this a literal dragon? Fire-breathing? With wings that fly? Jagged tail? No! Is this a literal serpent? Slithering on the ground? With fangs and venom? No! Is this a literal key in the angel's hand? No, beloved, a key is a standard biblical symbol for possessing authority over a place. Jesus says to Peter, I'm going to give you the keys to the kingdom. Did he have in mind a literal key? So is this a literal subterranean cavern? No. Is this a literal chain? How can a literal chain confine a spiritual being? I'm not going to be able to say this to you much longer. So let me say it to you again. Welcome to the world of apocalyptic. So why would you suddenly get literal with the number 1,000? Is that what this is, beloved? A period of 365,000 24-hour days? I mean, you've read 19 chapters thus far. Is that how you'd be inclined to see this? When God claims to own a cattle on 1,000 hills, are we to infer that the cattle on the 1,001st hill belongs to someone else? No, God owns all the cattle on all the hills. The idea of 1,000 suggests all of them. The number 1,000 is used to speak of the fullness of quantity. 10, the number of completion, cubed to the third power. And here you see the idea quite simply is this. Satan is bound for the entirety of a long period of time. Now, what does all of this mean? Well, what's being communicated to us here in this unique apocalyptic genre? Well, beloved, it becomes very clear when you understand the purpose clause in these three verses. What is this binding of Satan? What is the 1,000-year period? The answers to these questions become obvious when you answer a third question. Why is Satan bound? You want to know what the millennium is? Let the text tell you. Verse 2. He seized the dragon, that ancient serpent who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years, and threw him into the pit, and locked and sealed it over him. Why? So that he would deceive the nations no more. Your translation might say, so that he would no longer deceive the nations. Implication, that's what he had been doing prior to this binding. So the millennium is an extended period of time during which Satan is bound. But we're compelled to ask at this point, bound in what sense? Bound in the sense that he can do nothing at all? Bound in the sense that he can work no evil of any kind? No, the text tells us, beloved, the nature of this binding is that he cannot deceive the nations as he had been doing prior to this binding. That's all that it's saying. But that raises another question. What then is meant by this deceiving of the nations? And thankfully, John tells us. Verse 7. When the 1,000 years are ended, Satan will be released from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations. There it is. I wonder what he's talking about. At the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog. There's your Ezekiel 38 and 39 language. In order to gather them for the battle. They are as numerous as the sands of the sea. Now, friends, Satan is bound during this 1,000-year period so as to keep from deceiving the nations. That is, to keep him from persuading them to unite together in mass for the purpose of destroying the church of Jesus Christ once and for all. That's what this binding is that distinguishes the millennium. Now let me unpack this. Step back for a moment into the world of John the Apostle, okay? Because this can never mean to us what it didn't first mean to them. You step back into the first century and what do you discover? That it is a day of great spiritual darkness and desolation. Rome rules. And so the streets of every major city are lined with sanctuaries filled with idols of various kinds. Religious abominations and vices, pagan festivals and culture. To be sure, a few scattered churches dot the landscape of the Middle East by virtue of the work of the Apostle Paul and a few others. But by and large, paganism is everywhere present. But move backwards in time from that. Keep going back to that long period of human history that preceded the coming of Jesus Christ when things were far worse. All the nations, without exception, with the exception of the Jews, all the nations existed under the bondage of the devil. All the nations were covered in spiritual darkness. All the people groups of the world, save Israel, shrouded in despair and darkness. But was that to be the case forever? God begins to promise the coming of a Messiah, a king from the line of David. And if you remember, after he is born, just a few days old, he's taken up in the arms of that old man Simeon, who in turn cites the prophecy of Isaiah that this child will not only be glory for Israel, he'll be a light of revelation to the nations. In the outworking of God's redemptive program, the undeceiving of the nations had begun. Foreshadowed, I would remind you, by the visit of the Eastern Magi, exemplified by Jesus' contacts with a Roman centurion, a Canaanite woman, a Samaritan woman, a group of Greeks. The pattern is extended even further in the life of the church. When the gospel is preached on the day of Pentecost, people from every nation under heaven hear the good news. As the book of Acts unfolds, we see the conversion of the Jews, the conversion of the Samaritans, the conversion of the Romans and the Greeks, the gospel in fulfillment of the Great Commission, going to the four corners of the earth. It's the undeceiving of the nations. It's interesting how Paul himself interprets this while preaching to Gentiles. In Acts 14, he says, in past generations, God allowed all the nations to follow their own ways. In Acts 17, he says, while God has overlooked the times of human ignorance, he now commands all people everywhere to repent. And by, my friends, as we read church history, what do we discover? The gospel moving into the other regions of the Middle East, the gospel moving south into Africa, the gospel moving into southern Europe, western Europe, moving to the Far East, moving to the Americas. In other words, the particularism of the old age is given way to the universalism of the new. It's the undeceiving of the nations brought about by the coming and dying and rising and ascending of Jesus Christ, the light of the world. Now here's the point, and this is where I must not lose you, okay? As the progressive undeceiving of the nations began to unfold, during the days of Jesus' ministry, he correspondingly began to speak about a radical change that was occurring. A change that had been inaugurated in his coming. A change that had to do with the devil and the evil he could work in the lives of people. In Luke chapter 10, do you remember? Jesus sends out 70 missionaries, two by two, short-term missions assignment, to preach to the people that the kingdom of God had now come. And when they return to Jesus, what's their disposition? Oh, they're ecstatic! They're ecstatic at their success, and they say to Jesus, even the demons obey us! At which point Jesus says, I watched Satan fall from heaven like a flash of lightning. In other words, he speaks of Satan's demise in direct correspondence to the advancement of the missionary enterprise, the undeceiving of the nations. In John chapter 12, Jesus is approached by Greek people who are eager to meet him. Highly unusual at that point in time. And this is what triggers him to say, now the ruler of this world will be driven out. And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. Amazing. Once again, he speaks of Satan's demise in direct relationship to the advancement of the missionary enterprise, the undeceiving of the nations. After one particular situation, Matthew chapter 12, when Jesus casts out a demon, the Pharisees say, well, he casts out demons by the power of Satan. How does Jesus respond? By explaining the true basis for that exorcism. How can one enter a strong man's house and plunder his goods unless he first binds? Very same word as Revelation 20. The strong man. Then indeed he may plunder his house. Why can I cast out that demon? Why can I free this human being from the grip of the devil? Why can I plunder his house? Because he's been bound. Pull these passages together, beloved. The downfall of Satan, the casting out of Satan, the binding of Satan, all of which result in his inability to keep in his custody the nations which, until Christ came to bind him and steal them away from him, were altogether in his power. Again, beloved, I repeat, please don't misunderstand this. Satan is not bound in every sense. I'm not in any way suggesting that his influence has been completely curtailed. He can still work evil in people's lives. He can still devastate churches. But that is not how the text defines the millennium age. There's a lot that the devil can do. There's a lot that the devil does do under the providence of God. But what he can't do, what he is kept from doing during this age, according to Revelation 20, is prevent the spread of the gospel by mounting an anti-Christian army against the church so as to destroy her and all of her missionary endeavors. And again, beloved, this is not new to us. The very same concept was taught to us back in chapter 11. You remember that scene? Throughout the entirety of this age, marked out in chapter 11 as 42 months or 1260 days for the reasons we gave to you back then. The church functions as a witnessing agency in this world. Symbolized, if you recall, by two witnesses because the testimony is confirmed in the mouth of two witnesses. And what we discover in chapter 11 is, until that task is completed, no one can stop it if anybody presumes to do so. Remember what happens? Fire proceeds out of the witnesses' mouths and consumes their enemies. In other words, divine protection is provided for the church so as to secure the success of her evangelistic mission. Now that's exactly what this is, just cast in a different set of apocalyptic symbols. The devil is bound, not here for 42 months, but 1,000 years, so as to secure the success of the church in her evangelistic mission. Now, friends, you want to know how real this gets for us? It means that every time we see somebody baptized here, and they confess that they have turned away from their sins and are trusting in Jesus Christ for life eternal, Satan's inability to deceive the nations is being proclaimed afresh. All of it, you see, is just another graphic way of illustrating the proclamation of Jesus himself, who said, "I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it." And though this world with devils filled should threaten to undo us, we will not fear, for God has willed his truth to triumph through us. That's what I would say if given the opportunity this morning to stand before our suffering brothers and sisters in Nigeria. The fact of the matter is, beloved, that's what I would want to be assured of were I persecuted for the sake of the gospel. I would want to be assured of the fact that the gospel will not fail, that any suffering we may endure up to and even including death itself will not be in vain, precisely because we are living in the millennium, that period of time during which the ultimate destruction of Satan is expressed in a preliminary fashion, that he has been bound by the coming of Jesus Christ, and therefore the salvation of the nations cannot be thwarted. And so that's why, you see, we must preach on. We must keep on witnessing. That's why we talk, you see, about building student ministries and establishing training centers and planting churches. Friends, I know what some of you think, huh? I know what some of you think. Oh, we don't have enough money to plant a church. We don't have enough people to plant a church. Maybe we don't. But what would it say about our devotion to the gospel if we didn't dream and plan and pray and prepare for such things, especially since we know that the strong man has been bound and that his house may be plundered? The gospel will prevail. Now, it may not prevail through us, and in one very real sense, I don't even care. To know that it will prevail is enough for me to give my life to this task. It's why, young men and women, some of you right here in this room need to spend your life taking the gospel to the ends of the earth. You dream about fast cars and big houses and successful careers and getting a husband and getting a wife and having babies. It's about time you put that selfishness to death. That you stop thinking like an American and start living like a Christian. That you begin asking yourself and you begin asking Jesus, how can I serve the cause of the advancement of the gospel, the only endeavor in this life that is guaranteed to succeed? God does not promise you that your business will prosper. God does not promise that your marriage will be wonderful. God does not promise that your children will become Christians. God promises that the gospel will prevail, so go to the ends of the earth with it. You say, "Well, Art, what if going to the ends of the earth with the gospel kills me?" Ah, then for you, the benefits of the millennium will become even more glorious. We'll see that next week. Let's pray together.